This is Zach.
This is Ben.
And this is the Movie Vault. So today we are doing The Deer Hunter. It has won 5 Academy Awards. It was a very big deal at the time. It's 3 hours and 3 minutes. Take that, Endgame. It was in 1978, rated R, and Robert De Niro, Christopher Walken, and John Cazale. I love John Cazale now.
And I love Christopher Walken now.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you not love him before?
No, I loved him before, but I love him even more now.
Yeah. Well, this movie broke barriers and sent lots of message. Oh, Meryl Streep as well. Sorry. And
John Savage. Yeah. Who, by the way, was young once.
Yeah, apparently.
Meryl Streep, the classic example of a lot of times women in Hollywood are relegated to B-list roles after their period of youth ends, like, unfortunately, but that's how the industry has worked.
Are you calling her ugly now?
But Meryl Streep, that's not what I'm saying.
But it sounds
Meryl
like
Streep
that.
Continued to have a very successful career, and maybe even more successful than when she was younger, as I can think of, like, Devil Wears Prada comes to mind when I think of Meryl Streep. There's probably other roles, but that one's the one that comes to mind.
Don't Look Up.
Oh,
best,
yeah.
Best performance.
Obviously.
For
obviously.
Sure. Anyway, this film is a great film about the effects of the Vietnam War on a bunch of young Americans.
Apparently they're
Russian Americans.
Slavic Americans.
Slavic Americans, all right. And, yeah, it's kind of, Ben and I can split this into 3 different parts. You kind of have the first part of the movie where it's before the war. It's the wedding. It's the one-hour wedding scene, we call. And then there is the middle part of the movie, which is the actual war, where all these devastating and horrible bloody massacres and killings occur. And then there's the after effects of the movie, where your characters are interacting with each other differently than they were at the wedding at the beginning. And you get to see how the war has changed them. And I think that is beautiful. And I'm going to start off, Ben. I think I love this movie very much. I told you this already, so I'm just restating. But it after I watched this movie, I felt satisfied. Living in America in the 21st century, you never feel satisfied. You always want more, you know? But I did not feel like I needed more of this movie, especially since it was 3 hours.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't feel like you could need any more of this movie than you got. It sort of tied up most things. And, yeah, it left you feeling satisfied, even though everything doesn't work out for all of the characters, but you still have this feeling of, like, I went through this journey with these people. Also made me realize that maybe I need to go to war with my best friends to really know what our relationships are like. So, Zach, I think we should enlist.
No.
No.
I could be an army medic. We could be army medics.
That's true. Both of us are going into careers that we could easily transition into the army.
No, that would be great. So, actually, The Deer Hunter was actually based on an unproduced screenplay called The Man Who Came to Play by A. Garfinkel and Quinn K. Redecker. And that is cool because it had some inspiration. But when I think it was... So, when it was directed by Michael... Pronounce his last name. Is it Camino?
Camino... I need to look... I feel like I know who this guy is, but also...
Yeah, it's Camino. And... So, I don't really know much about him. I was hoping you knew enough something about
I actually,
him.
Honestly, he's one of those guys that I was like, I feel like I know this guy, but...
Okay.
Let's go through his filmography real quick.
All right.
Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, The Deer Hunter, Heaven's Gate, Year of the Dragon, The Sicilian, Desperate Hours, The Sun Chaser. No translation needed. That's it.
Okay.
Have I heard of any of those movies? I think I've heard of Heaven's Gate. But I couldn't tell you what it's about. And maybe The Sicilian also, I'm assuming it's about a Sicilian. So, this is definitely his most well-known movie.
Yeah.
But, for some reason I thought this movie was directed by Oliver Stone, but it was not. I don't
it's
know
a
why
weird
I thought
thought that.
That
you had.
Yeah, Oliver Stone, different director.
Yeah.
Probably directed a different war movie.
That's all right. But, yes. I would like to first ask Ben, what was your first initial reaction of the wedding scene? Let's start there, because I think that wedding scene was so long, and at first I was like, where is this movie going? When are we going to get to the killings? Not that I love killing, but in a movie, you're allowed to. You're allowed to love killing. I think it was really... I liked the character interactions at the wedding. You got to see how jokey these 6 people are, right? Including one girl. They they are very, like, one of them is, like, dancing with the girl, and the other one's, like, laughing when the girl rejects him. And it's just, like, they are just completely having fun the entire time, completely drunk, at the bar, going back and forth between work and the bar, looks like. And it's, like, really a, like a, I don't know, like, you could relate to that kind of group of friends almost.
Yeah, it's like, imagine... you know, your four or five closest friends or your closest friend group all hanging out, having a good time. And that's just what the first hour of the movie is. Actually, my favorite scene is in this part of the movie. Can you guess which scene it is, Zach?
I actually can't, no.
You can't? Okay. My favorite, and I couldn't really necessarily tell you why this is my favorite scene.
Wait, hold on.
In the whole movie.
No, I still can't know.
But it's gonna be the scene where they're at the bar and they're playing pool, and I forget what the name of the guy is. I have the song downloaded now. It's like Frankie Avali and the Four Seasons. Yeah. It is famous in the 50s, and the song is called it's called Can't Take My Eyes Off You.
Okay.
Yeah, it's Frankie Avali and the Four Seasons.
Why is that your favorite?
And so, for whatever reason, when Christopher Walken just starts belting out the song and he's like dancing, like it hits me in a like area, like the music and the how jovial they are and the like camaraderie all together. And you see Robert De Niro is like over in the corner, like nodding his head, like smiling. and that was like after I watched the movie, that was the scene that I like looked up after the movie to like rewatch. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it's not necessarily the wedding, but it's leading up to right after the mother of the bride comes in and like yells at the guy because he's supposed to be like getting married. That's and he's hilarious. Like in the bar, like yeah. Drinking. It does kind of represent like the friend group, but like just that, I really just have that image of Christopher Walken just like belting out, don't worry, baby. Or whatever that first line is
don't
in the core.
Don't worry, baby.
That line right there. And it's like a song that I'm familiar with, but like I hadn't really paid attention to, and now I like listen to it all the time.
Now, Christopher Walken is interesting because I have not seen him this young, ever.
No.
I've seen him as an old fellow.
He looks like Christopher Walken.
He does, but he's beautiful. He's a beautiful guy. And his hair is big, but like now what happened... He looks much different. So you look at him as like this crummy old guy in his movies he does recently. But then you look back and you're like, now I know why he was famous.
Yeah, and like Christopher Walken's one of those guys who, he has sort of like a cult following or like a... He has some sort of aura. I don't know how to describe it. I put him in the same class as like Willem Dafoe and... that's really the most comparable other actor I can think of. But the thing is, if you look at Christopher Walken's, the movies that he's worked in, versus Willem Dafoe, you'll see that Christopher Walken has been in far less critically acclaimed films, I believe, and works in far more films in general.
Hmm.
And I think like there's a lot of niche films that people like that, like The King of New York, I think, some of those, which I haven't necessarily seen, but I've heard of in like some, like the rewatchable type of film settings.
Gotcha.
Whereas, like, Defoe is in, like, you know, The Lighthouse, like, now modern.
Spider-Man No Way Home.
Or maybe Joaquin Phoenix, even. Like,
that's a good sort of class.
But he's more mainstream, I think, than
Joaquin them. Became more mainstream with Joker.
Yeah.
But before that, Ethan.
But, like, I think Christopher Walken is a little bit less eccentric than Willem Dafoe and Joaquin Phoenix in his acting style.
I agree.
He still has that kind of strange, like...
I agree. His characters are way more normal.
Yeah.
I would agree. But I would agree with the cult following aspect. I don't know anything about Christopher Walken's, but Joaquin Phoenix and Willem Dafoe definitely have cult followings.
Right. I saw that in the Wikipedia article about Christopher Walken. It was like, yeah, he does have a cult following. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of made me think of those two actors to compare him to.
Now, you're right. I think that scene was a good introduction for the characters in general, for the six main characters, five at the time. Now, these guys are best friends. They've obviously been friends for many years. They're okay joking with each other about very serious matters, about their lives, about how pathetic they are. And you know, they hurt each other. They're guys. They're just whatever, ragging on. I don't know what you say, ragging on each other.
The way they show love is by, like, making fun of them in, like, the worst way possible.
And they don't ever talk about anything serious. That's how guys are. That's just how it is. Most guys. And we can all relate to that in some way with some group of friends that we have. And I think that's great. I did enjoy the wedding scene. I did not think it was too long. I was a little worried that they were going to make it longer, but so I looked a little ahead and I went back and I was like, nope, it's not going to be this forever. So it was cool. It was nice to see, besides all the Russian choirs in the background, it was cool to see the different characters, how they're reacting to their friends. And then I think the best part of this movie is the beginning. There's not just one scene, it's a couple different scenes where the characters, all of a sudden, it's a happy moment, and then all of a sudden you, the camera will pan or cut to a character's face, and their face is very somber because they know they're about to go to the war. And think each character, so Christopher Walken, Robert De Niro, and is it John Savage, they played that very well. Like, throughout the night of the wedding, they looked like they made fun of the Green Beret guy. And Robert De Niro, I don't know their names, I'm just saying their actors' names. Robert De Niro goes and he's like, why are you not telling me, you know, whatever, he says different language. But and it was just cool to see that kind of, it wasn't even foreshadowing, because you know what's going to happen, you know they're going to war, they said that at the beginning, but to see how the friends are going to react, you know what this movie is about right away. You know that this movie is about, they're going to war and they're going to have serious moments, and the friends that aren't going to war, they're going to interact with them again, and it's going to be way different. And you can predict that at the end of the movie, did you?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, in a sense. I feel like I don't spend a lot of time predicting stuff in movies, like, in my head.
You're along for the ride?
I'm along for the ride. Right. And I don't know whether that's because I'm actually dumb or because I, like, just put myself in a dumb state.
No.
But I think by the end it was pretty natural to be realized, like, oh, they're not the same. Because, the most dramatic cut in the whole movie is when it cuts from the wedding to them being imprisoned in Vietnam. There's no transition. It's just straight there. And then you see, like, the horrors of the war that they had to go through. And, like, it's obvious that that is going to change a person forever. Like, and I don't know, like, this is 1979. I don't know how much they, like, talked about PTSD. But I think, like, I think it was becoming a thing, because Taxi Driver, which came out 4 years earlier, is, you know, one of the more famous movies of kind of the last 50 years, is essentially about PTSD. And then this movie is, you could argue, becomes sort of about how post-traumatic stress disorder can, and war, and how that affects people mentally, and how that transitions into affecting more people. You know, it's like a broader brush than Taxi Driver is, but it's hitting on that same idea. Because the Vietnam War was just such a, like, tense era for the entire country, and this is 10 years after-ish. And so now we know more about the effects that it had longer term. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. We had said this. I think this movie reminds me of a less comedic Full Metal Jacket, where it is very critical of the Vietnam War and what occurred there. You know, I wasn't there. I honestly have no idea. But I haven't even learned anything in history about the Vietnam War. And it wasn't that long ago, but I haven't learned about it at all. And these movies are kind of getting me interested in, like, what happened? I don't know.
Most of what I understand about the Vietnam War comes from these movies.
Really? Like, that's probably not a good thing.
No, it's not. Yeah. Because, they're not teaching you the history of the Vietnam War. They're just showing you, like, one possible experience that people had. And also, like, this is, like, a specific experience. They're in I looked up the town that it's based in. It's in, like, western Pennsylvania, which is traditionally, like, a steel area of the country, like the Rust Belt. A lot of steel factories. Now, like, a lot of western Pennsylvania is kind of run down and depressed, other than Pittsburgh, because steel kind of died after, I think, like, basically in the 70s, 80s era was when all of those towns started to decline because steel factories shut down. They don't even get into that because they're not in that point in history yet. It's just interesting to note. But
now, sorry, go ahead.
But I don't know. I know that it was controversial because it was about, like, we're going and we're aiding this country against communism, but like we're not directly involved. The U.S. is not directly involved, so they're getting involved in another country's civil war, essentially. And this has been an aspect of U.S. military that a lot of people have been critical of. I feel like people on both sides of political left or right, depending on where you fall in certain things, would have disagreements with the military decisions that are made at a very high level based on like getting involved in other countries' affairs. There's obviously, it's very complex. Like, you can't just make a form an opinion on a like base level understanding of how these complex international politics work. But I think it's kind of one of those interesting topics, because to me, at least from how I view it, it seems like there would be people on both sides of the aisle who would like be critical of the use of funds. Other people might not see it that way, but that's how I see it, at least.
Just tweet about it.
I'll just tweet it out. I'll be like, red or blue, you don't like spending money on the military.
But now, I do want to point this out. So you did just say, do you know what your taxi driver was?
75.
So that kind of makes sense. So mental disorders, I just looked this up. This is a weird thought I'm having. So the DSM, so this is the, I forget what it's actually called, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. So that was that actually came out like very a long time ago in 1952. But then the second and third edition, so third edition was published in 1980. So in between there, they were actually developing these new ideas of mental disorders. I wonder if that had an effect on what this was, because now they just added like ADHD and stuff like that to.
Right.
They took off a lot of other things how the society is changing in the 21st century. So I'm wondering, because that's when kind of they started to classify mental disorders. So it kind of makes sense why this movie is kind of tackling a complex idea like that. And Taxi Driver, because you're right, there probably are a lot of PTSD movies like that back. For us, it's a century ago,
yeah,
whatever, but not really, but it's a long time.
Also, I think, and this is going to be kind of a generalization, but the 70s was like a grimier era of film in general. Like, they started to have less restrictions on what they could put in movies, and so this is coming at the tail end of that. We get movies like A Clockwork Orange, Midnight Cowboy in the late 60s, which are X-rated technically. Nowadays they have been like reverted back to R rating. I don't even think they use the X rating in NPAA anymore, but those kind of movies come out, and then all the way to here. So people are more, I think there's in this period of the 70s, there's economic crisis at different points, and people are watching entertainment that is now starting to be more politically charged and more about like modern day issues, which now it's interesting to look back on, because when these movies came out, they were dealing with like issues that were current or recent, and now we're looking at them as more historical. So we're going to have two different like perspectives on that.
That is interesting. I'm wondering, when we think of a movie like Don't Look Up that addresses global warming and COVID, now that is considered a current event, obviously. When people look back on that, is it going to be the same? The Deer Hunter won 5 Academy Awards. Don't Look Up did not. There's obviously a quality difference. There's obviously a difference in the script and the direction and the director and the actors. But are people going to look back at that and say, that is history, and we can learn stuff from this movie? Not that you should, but could they? I don't know.
I see, and this is something that I'm having to think about, because I always thought, that I had this thought when I watched the movie Vengeance that came out recently, which also dealt with a lot of current issues more related to like social media and the internet and how news is portrayed. Actually tackles podcasting a little bit, interestingly enough. But I went out of the movie and I was like, in 5 years, is anybody gonna like be able to relate to this? Because technology is gonna shift so much, and this will be like a relic of the past. Like, a lot of times using certain technologies in films, like when you watch a movie and they're still using like one of those like flip phone type things, or the phones that have the keyboards that come out, you're like, oh, that's weird.
Like a BlackBerry, you mean?
Yeah, like a BlackBerry. It just looks like strange. It doesn't look, you're not thinking of it as like historical. But I guess at some point, though, as time has passed enough, you might start to look at that with more nostalgia and then not think of it as like, oh, this is really corny because it's like... Oh.
That sounds right, actually. But we're going to be watching it from the metaverse. It's going to be great. We're going to be like, this is historical fiction, but it's based in history. And I think that's what we have to take from this movie. I don't know. I consider myself uneducated in the Vietnam War. Okay? So please don't tell me I should be educated. I'll do that. Just give me time, all right?
Let me find a class that I need for my general education.
Sure, why not? Course. I mean, that's going to be way more biased, probably.
Yeah, that's true. Some history professor.
Coming from a liberal arts college. Now, but The Deer Hunter specifically deals with these issues close to the time when they were occurring. And I'm wondering if that had an effect on its commercial success. Now, it won five Academy Awards, as I've said. And it made about $49 million off of a $15 million budget, which is pretty good, especially for the time and for a three-hour movie. You know, people back then had more free time, you know? But now, does that translate? Do you think it would be as successful if a movie like this were to be made about current events, like Don't Look Up, with high quality, good director, you know, all those things that made this movie great? Do you think that it would be commercially successful, Ben?
I think that in all likelihood, a movie like this would come out onto streaming, which would make it difficult to tell whether it was commercially successful.
So you're saying the market's just different?
Yeah.
The way that it's distributed
is different. Because this is going to be a really bad comparison, but it's like the only thing that I can think of that like kind of compares in any sense. And that is The Irishman, which came out 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. 3-hour movie, came out onto Netflix. Now, you could argue that the only reason that that movie is able to be made is because the Martin Scorsese, who's been directing movies since the beginning of time, has so much brand power that it doesn't matter what he can just kind of decide what he wants to do and people will watch it.
And he always chooses the mafia.
Yeah, and it's mafia. It's not related to war or anything. So, but the thing is, so what our modern comparisons to this are Catherine Bigelow movies, like Zero Dark Thirty and The Hurt Locker, neither of which I've seen, sadly.
You're saying those address issues?
Benghazi and the killing of Osama bin Laden.
What about like Vice?
Vice would be another example of something that.
But those aren't as far. Would this be closer to the actual date though?
Vice would be in a comparable range because it came out in 2016 and it's talking about, but Vice is about a person. It's not about like a
true.
It's about a real person. Like it's not exactly comparable.
No, it's not.
And it's a comedy ish weird thing.
But it's addressing a controversial
current
figure idea.
Yeah.
That's been current or recently.
And it got nominated for an Academy Award. Okay. Again, I don't think in quality wise it's as good as The Deer Hunter. So okay, so. I don't know whether this goes as much to your question, but when you watch The Deer Hunter, do you feel like there's just like a style of filmmaking that they don't use anymore? Like,
yes.
Yeah, because it's just like these people just like talking and laughing. Like Vice, for example, has so much like snappy editing and cuts, and it's like I don't think there's narration, but it feels more like there might be like titles and things describing where things are. Like, The Deer Hunter is like a movie in the sense that it's trying to immerse you into the environment. Mm. And it's just, there's something about like the texture of the colors and the audio quality and stuff that you don't really, like, everything's so brushed up and polished nowadays that it feels like you kind of lose some of that.
Yeah.
And which is a weird thing to say, that like the audio quality being better in some sense of like the technology is better is actually making the movie worse. Like, I don't know if that's what I'm trying to argue that.
No, but you have a point. You're saying that that's the consequences of everything being so overly sparkly these days. This movie, what it did good is it was almost like you were there. You could literally make this seem like an episode of The Office where you're zooming in with a camera and being a documentary, right? But it's not a documentary. It's doing different cuts and stuff like that. But it's also allowing each and every scene to breathe. I'm against 3-hour movies. Unless it's Endgame where it's warranted, or people who have earned the right to it, like Martin Scorsese. But I am usually against 3-hour movies. Ben and I,
we always say if you can make it an hour and a half, you should.
Yeah, and this movie, I don't think could have done it in an hour and a half. It would not have been breathed. But if this movie were to come out these days, it would have been an hour and a half, and it would have been the same story, but it wouldn't have been as good. Why? Because it wouldn't have time to breathe. You had every single character give a range of emotions within one scene, because each scene isn't just about one thing. The camera is on these characters, and different things are going to happen. So you could have one conversation with these characters. So they're in a room, say, let's say it's a 10-minute scene. These scenes are so long. Let's say it's a 10-minute scene, or we could even go even more general in the wedding. How many different things happen in that one wedding scene? It's a third of the movie. So many different things. And you're allowing the scene to take place in a specific area, in a specific time, in a specific place. And I already said area, but with the specific people. And they're trying... Sorry, that's my rice maker going off in the background. You're able to actually feel like you're there because of these specific things and allowing it to play out as it would. You're not cutting back and forth and having to, like, take in more information. You already have the information, and you're breathing in there. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I definitely agree with what you're saying. Because, yeah. I mean, it's just... I'm trying to figure out the right words to frame what I'm trying to, or maybe just like go further off of what you're trying to describe. Like the hunting scene, for example.
Yeah.
They're just out hunting, and like some of them have guns. They go into this whole conversation about how this one guy forgot boots, and Robert Niro's like, I'm not giving you my extra set of boots. You gotta remember to bring your stuff. And it can feel kind of like, I think there might be some schools of filmmaking who believe that you have to make everything have an intense purpose. Like, and you can't just have characters like have these types of conversations that are don't seem as important to the like intricate point of the plot. But then also because the movie's so sprawling, you realize that there's not necessarily an entirely focused message. It's like, you experience so many things and you feel so many things that by the end of the movie, you feel like every type of way. You feel happy in some senses. You feel sad in some senses. You feel like there was, like, you went on a journey and you just, there's not words that can always describe it's a very heartfelt thing. Because I'm struggling here to describe what I felt about this movie, because it feels deeper than just words.
Maybe an example of that would be in a movie that would come out today, each and every scene would be related completely to the plot, right? Or to comedic effect. Now, this movie, you don't necessarily have every scene related to the plot. You have the hunting scene, right? But I think it plays on two levels. I think if you have these extra scenes that aren't related to the plot, one, it's allowing the film to breathe, as I said, and two, they actually are related to the theme of the movie. You just don't get it yet. You don't get it until really the end, you know? Which makes me go to the next part. So after the wedding, it just cuts. There is just a cut, you know? The director decides to just go straight into, and it wasn't even like a fast cut, it was just like, it just showed they were done with one scene and it went right into the jungle and there was a helicopter going and it was the Vietnam War and all these terrible things happen. You just open up with these killings, you know, this guy throws a grenade into a little underground hut, I don't know, underground thing where these Vietnamese people were, and they all die except for a baby and a mom, and they kill them with the flamethrower. So it's just like very fast, 0 to 100.
Yeah.
And we expected that. Did you expect that 0 to 100? I know this is another prediction. You said you don't predict.
Zero to 100. So, no, I don't think I did. Yeah, because, like, there's nothing. I was like, this. Okay, they're in the wedding. Like, I knew about the wedding. And I think I even had briefly read that there was going to be, like, three parts to the movie. Okay. So, but I think I was, which they said a wedding. And I was like, well, there's probably a funeral. But I was like, what's in the middle? I didn't really, like, you know, think about it too much. But I thought it was a really good stylistic choice to just go straight into it and not hold, not have this weird, like, well, they didn't really have time to even do a transitional thing where they're, like, going off into war and they're, like, getting adjusted to Vietnam.
He specifically chose to let the film breathe in the wedding and then skip all the breathing and go straight into the next phase of the movie, the war. And that was intentional, that drastic change of you have been with these characters for every single minute for the past hour, and now you're going to skip ahead all this time after basic training and going in and all this stuff.
And I think the other crazy thing is that in this movie, one of the things that struck me was that you don't need to show the war that much for it to be a war movie, because they go through this 20-minute sequence or so, I don't know how long it was exactly, of them going through this whole Russian roulette torture circuit with where eventually it's Mike, Robert De Niro's character, and is he facing off Nick at this point? Or is he facing off with a Vietnamese prisoner?
At first...
He's facing off with Nick.
No, Nick first faces with the Vietnamese guy, right?
Yeah.
And then Mike comes in.
Yeah, and then Mike comes in. And then Mike kills every... He goes bananas, kills everyone. And then they have to go over and rescue Steven, mm-hmm. who is the John Savage's character.
And I'm so dumb. I didn't realize that was the guy that got married until like 30 minutes later. Yeah,
because I mean, the faces are, they're so obscured. Like,
exactly.
It's kind of hard to tell who's who. You obviously know who Robert De Niro and Christopher Walken is, but after that, it's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Who anyone is. And then they escape. They eventually get rescued. So that's it. That's like the war part of the movie. It's super intense, though.
Mm-hmm.
It will leave a mark. Like, you'll remember it.
They get rescued, and well, Christopher gets rescued, right? And then they get left behind. Is that what he said?
I don't know that
they
I said that.
They get left behind, and he walks. He takes Steven. Robert De Niro takes Steven. I'm just mixing up names. Takes Steven to the mainland where they're safe or whatever.
Right. Right. Okay. Yeah.
So then that's how they get separated. Is Walken gets rescued, the other two don't.
Yeah, and then. With Walken, it becomes a strange thing for where Nick ends up with this weird French guy, and he somehow... So this was a part of the movie that I was a little confused by. So at first it seems like he's like, no, I'm not going to be part of it. I don't want anything to do with you. But then all of a sudden he's like, goes off with this French guy to become a Russian roulette professional,
mm-hmm.
which this was another thing that I was not aware of being a thing.
I'm so confused with that idea, though.
Because it's like, it's the highest stakes, like, possible.
But how can thing. You become a professional in that?
Right, because it's not...
He's lucky.
It's like, it's gambling in the truest sense. But what is the players gain out of it? I don't know. But...
Money, maybe.
I guess you get money, yeah. It's like you have a pimp and you make some money and the...
Pretty much.
The pimp gets money. And the
French guy would be his.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, that makes sense. I mean, that's... That's just an interesting element of the movie that I wasn't expecting that they would add. Like, Russian roulette. Like, with the Vietnam War. Like, let's just shove those two things together, you know? Like, was that a common practice
in
the Vietnam War? I'm so confused.
This movie makes you assume that this was some sort of, like, common... There must have been some sort of underground scene in Vietnam. I don't know how big it was or how much we really actually know about it, because it's... underground, so but I don't know what this
sorry
was a torture.
This is Reddit, Ask Historians Reddit. It says, although it's always hard to prove a negative, Russian roulette was not prevalent at all during the war, neither by North or South Vietnamese soldiers or by American soldiers. There are no documented cases,
and I suppose that's like, yeah, that might be something that's more of a rumor or like a story, because, well, it's underground, like, of course, historian, like, they're not making this like a public thing. They're in like sketchy, like, areas. So if we do know about it, it's through like not reputable sources that it existed. So who knows whether it did or not?
That's pretty reputable.
Well, yeah. Of course, he doesn't. He says he can't prove a negative. So
now the cool thing about this element of the movie is you have like three or four of these scenes where you don't know if your favorite character or whatever is gonna die. And it obviously pays off in the end with the death of Nikki. So, leading up to that scene, you have, like, a couple different events, right? You have the first one where the Vietnamese soldiers are forcing them to play. And they don't want to play, right? And somehow, that creates an an imprinted image on them, at least on Nicky, to where he's so comfortable doing that. He would. So Nicky was the most reluctant to do it. Mike was willing, right?
Yeah.
Mike does it right away. Nicky is like, very reluctant.
It's gonna be okay. Yeah.
Exactly. But then that event was so scarring for Mike, for Nicky, that he eventually makes it what he does. He doesn't know anything else. That experience is so traumatic and it becomes so centric in his life that he can't think of anything. He does it for a living.
Yeah.
Why would he do that? Why is he running towards that? He had a choice and he chose to do that. Why do you think?
I wish I'm not a psychologist, so yes, I wish.
You are. Just guess.
So I wish it's got to be like some sort of reaction to, like, it felt like he became an animal, like, by the end of the movie, like when he faces off with Mike the second time,
mm-hmm.
which is like, I couldn't tell you why Mike is wired in a way that this was like. So I want to stop here. I wonder if there's a point at the start of the film where we're supposed to see the difference between Nick and Mike's attitudes towards going to war, and whether this middle part is like Mike being, has always the confident one, right, at the start of the movie, that like they're going to come back and that everything's going to be okay. Whereas I think Nick's a little bit more reluctant or scared in general.
Yeah.
Do you think that's like,
that was one of the first scenes. After they come home from the bar, they go sit down, and he's opening. He says, "I won't go hunting with anyone else," right? And he's talking about the war. And Nicky was afraid, and Mike kind of had to reassure him.
Right.
So it was kind of that situation. Mike was obviously like the leader hero in this.
He's the group leader, the alpha male.
Exactly.
Character. So that's not explained why this is, but for whatever reason, he has this sort of he's like the stereotypical like concrete, strong male, immovable mental object, whether it's like super realistic that he can be that way, but he's the one who ends up in the movie having the most like sanity by the end, although he's definitely affected by everything else that goes around him. It's not in as extreme of a sense as his compadres, and so maybe Nick's like weakness at it breaks him, essentially, that he went through that experience. And then again, it's like he becomes a robot or an animal, where he just, it's like he's free to be programmed by this other guy somehow. I don't know where the leap is, but once he makes the leap, he's there. He's not coming out of it.
Yeah.
Because we get the face off at the end where Mike goes back to Vietnam, which was, again, not a thing that I expected to happen.
No.
Like, I was like, so Mike comes back. Steven doesn't have any legs. They have to deal with the fact that he's newly married, but he doesn't really want to go back with his family because he feels out of place. And then Mike ends up with Nick's girlfriend, who's played by Meryl Streep.
Why? Why did that storyline occur?
Well, it was started at the start of the movie when it was like pretty obvious that like they kind of had a thing for each other, despite the fact that she also liked Nick.
But was that just to add a layer of this guy's not perfect? Or what did you add with...
I don't know what you really add with that storyline.
I don't know either.
Well, yeah, it's like, obviously if Nick would have come back, it would have been kind of a problem. Like,
yeah.
It's like, yeah, I was sleeping with
good
your...
Good thing he died,
with
yeah.
your girlfriend.
Yeah, he's like, well, that really worked out for me.
But then you wonder if Nick would have come back. He's not the same person, so whether he would have even gone back to...
I don't know. But that's a theme. People aren't the same people.
Yeah.
So, let's start with Mike. What is different about Mike? I'll start. I think Mike no longer wants to tolerate the fun antics that they used to do as a friend group. Before, everybody was getting drunk, partying, saying nasty things to each other, you know, hitting on each other's significant others. And it was like fun and games constantly. And they would joke around about killing and guns, you know? And Mike was a part of that. Now, post-war, he's come out a veteran. He kind of feels, he even mentions this, that he feels distant. And why does he feel distant? I think it's because the serious things that he has experienced has caused him to take life more seriously, whereas these buffoons that he's been with the whole time, and including, he was a buffoon too, don't take life seriously at all.
I completely agree with this.
Yeah.
And it's, the culmination of that is in the scene where they're messing around with the gun, and Mike's like points the gun and makes the guy.
Now, did he know there wasn't? It wasn't gonna shoot him. I'm so confused about that.
Did he hold the gun up to his head and pull the trigger?
Yes.
And it didn't shoot. But there was a bullet in it. So he made it. He did a Russian roulette on him. And it's like, if I was that guy's friend, like, I understand he went to war, but I'm like taking a step back from that friendship.
They're like okay in the next scene.
Yeah, that's
my friend just tried to shoot.
That's the thing. I mean, he's like. He's going to an extreme measure. Maybe this is the most extreme thing that he does. To point out that they can't joke around about guns and shooting each other. It's a little bit ironic that he ends up like pointing the gun at him and pulling the trigger. But it's like this. Like he's been through it and he sees this is not a joking matter. This is not something that we can make fun of because he sees the damage that these things have on people, mm-hmm. Even if they're like accidents. Gun accidents happen because people are stupid with guns.
Yeah.
I mean, they know the people who know gun safety are a lot of times involved in gun accidents because they have been around guns so much that they forget about the devastating effect that they can have.
You just forget.
Yeah.
Like Alec Baldwin.
They feel invincible. Yeah.
Like Alec Baldwin. That was a terrible thing, but you're right. So that I think we encompass that perfectly. What about Steven? I feel like that was just. He was just affected because his legs were blown off.
Yeah, which, of course, would affect anybody.
Yeah. It? And then he obviously becomes mentally ill.
Yeah.
So I mean, I don't know what else.
He's, like, not capable of, at least at the beginning of the movie, he's not capable of going back to civilian life. That's what they're hinting at.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, it's great here. I love being in this hospital, and they treat us well. And I fit in because everyone else is messed up and broken, mm-hmm. just like him, and he can relate to them.
We should go.
I mean, the biggest thing is that these people come back to society, and they can no longer relate to the people in society because they've gone through completely different experiences that have changed who they are as people. And so he's like, I feel more at home with these people than I feel with my family. And, like, my wife, like... You know, we got married and then we didn't see each other for months.
What happened to the wife?
I think they eventually, like, he came back into society.
But what? Why wasn't she talking?
She did talk to Mike a couple times.
But, like,
she seemed just upset.
Okay. So I wasn't sure if she had mental disorder, too.
I mean, possibly.
I don't know. So, yeah, Steve was also the least capable to do what he needed to do in war.
Yeah.
He was the one who was freaking out the entire time and had to be comforted by Mike. And he was the one who couldn't, you know, pull the trigger or do whatever and couldn't stand up. So he was also the one who broke. So I think Steve was just, I don't want to say weaker, because anybody, I feel like I would break and I'm not weak.
Well, that's what I think. If anything, the realistic characters are Steve and Nick. Yeah. Well, maybe not even Nick, because I don't know whether it's realistic that you end up in a underground Russian roulette ring, but, But Steve, just because, like, how many people are really like Mike, where they are so strong? I mean, there has to be, because the training that they do for some of those special forces and stuff is like they try to train people for these situations. And how, I mean, you can't really be trained for these situations, but they turn them into different people before they even go out into the, like, they put them through crazy stuff, mm-hmm. in order that they're prepared before they go out. Obviously, these people had not been not that you can prepare to be in a, like, concentration camp or whatever setting, prisoner of war setting, but, like, they were thrown into the fire in Vietnam.
You know, it's really sad. This is very unrelated. John Cazale died the year this movie came out.
Yeah, I actually did see that he had terminal cancer.
That's terrible.
He died at age 42. He was dating Meryl Streep?
No.
Yeah, this is also in the Wikipedia article. Yeah, it said he is in a relationship with Meryl Streep, and the studio wanted to fire him because he had terminal cancer. And
what?
And Meryl Streep and Michael Camino, whatever you say his name.
Camino.
They both said that they would quit the movie if
Well, yeah, that's a terrible way to fire someone. Come on.
The studio wanted to fire him, but Streep, with whom he was in a relationship, and Cimino threatened to walk away if they did. And he was uninsurable, and De Niro paid for his insurance because he wanted Cazale in the film. So, I mean, you hear stories about this, but, like, sometimes people in Hollywood do take care... I mean, they take care of each other, I think. They might,
they do.
You they might not be the greatest people overall, but...
You should listen to the oral history of The Office. They were a family when they made that show. It's unrelated, but that reminded me of that. So, yeah. So, that takes me to the third person. So, we have, like, a very bravo macho man who has changed because he now takes life more seriously. You have a very, you know, you have a less macho man who... didn't really, he was kind of flaky even in his relationship, who doesn't really take life seriously, who is then put through these, you know, hell basically, and then comes back broken, completely destroyed, not normal, left his old identity, is just okay with being broken. Now you have this third character who is, and by the way, these are all in reference to the other three characters that are left behind, you know? So you have these three characters that went to the war, change. Then you have the three characters left behind. Those three characters are what? The three different comedic characters.
Yeah.
And they don't change the entire movie. One, to keep comedy in the movie. Two, I think, because you can't really change the comedy character. I don't know.
Well, I think it's also to prove the point that while these people were at war, life didn't really change that much for everyone else.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. For the plot purposes, of course.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Nicky... I would consider him a sweetheart at the beginning. I kind of like him at the beginning. He's tough. I mean, you know, he's tough. He stands up to people, but he's kind of a sweetheart. He kind of like is reasonable, right? Isn't he reasonable? He's like, give him his boots. You know?
He seems like the most, Mike seems a little like, off, like he makes weird choices sometimes and a little strange. Nicky seems like put together and like, macho and all of that. I would have to say.
Yeah, and so why do you think Nicky changed? What do you think was the breaking point? That he obviously went to a breaking point where he is robotic.
Do you think that Nicky had more to lose than Mike?
He had a woman.
Yeah.
What else? That's it.
That's true. That's
Steven all he had the most to lose. He had a wife and a kid.
Because Mike, you could argue that Mike had the least to lose out of everyone, but how much less was it than Nicky, really?
I don't know, but would that affect why he broke? I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah, that's an interesting thing to think about. Like, what was it specifically about Nicky that caused him? Because this is one of those things that the movie is trying to let you discover on your own, because it is a very... Like, it doesn't seem like the most... it wouldn't be the transition that you just would think would happen.
Yeah. Why did these three men who were best friends all react to the war differently in such drastically different ways? And Nicky's is by far the worst. And he was the most reasonable. What does that mean? What do you think?
It's better to be unreasonable when you're going to war because it's an unreasonable situation that you're going into.
I think that I had noticed that in the movie, and I think that's one of the theses of the movie. I think that you're supposed to like Nicky as one of the main characters at the first in Act 1. And I think in Act 2 you see him be the most reluctant to pull the triggers. And then you see him in Act 3 the most willing to pull the triggers and does on himself. Now, why is that? Because he's reasonable. Why did Mike and Steve not... you know, go so far in their thinking and be affected so much? Because they weren't as... I don't want to call Nicky selfless, but I feel like he was more selfless than Mike or Steven. Because Steven literally stayed home or was getting drunk the day of his wedding or whatever, or before his wedding. That's pretty selfish. Mike keeping his boots, that's kind of selfish, right? I know that's a lesser extent.
Yeah.
But, and then you have Nicky, in all situations, kind of putting himself in helping out. You know, he's the best man. He's trusted, right? Why is he the best man? You know, you can go into all these different things. But Nicky's not even the main character. Mike is, right? Kind of, right? Would you say that?
Yeah, Mike's
He's
definitely the main character. I mean, Mike is definitely the main character.
So, Nicky is gone from the movie. Why? And you like him. You do like him at the beginning of the movie. I mean, did you like him? Because I don't.
Oh, I love Nicky.
Okay, yeah. I'm just making sure that we're on the same page on that, because this is the point that I'm trying to make from that. You liking him the most, him breaking the most, it makes it more heartbreaking as well. If he's your favorite character, seeing him die at the end by killing himself is heartbreaking. And it's based on their three, not even personalities, but I don't. It wasn't their views of the war, right? Because it wasn't their views of the war that made them react differently.
They seemed reluctant to go to the war, but none of them were like questioning of like the morality or the whether or not they should go to the war.
No.
You know what I mean? It wasn't about that. It was more about the risk of going to a war that was weighing on them.
No. There was a line that someone said, they don't want us here. And that was the same. There was the same line that was in Full Metal Jacket. So it's obvious they're obviously taking the same route of they don't want the Americans there. The Americans are making it worse is what they're trying to say.
Yeah.
Now, how that plays out in this movie is pretty spectacular, because you have this random Russian roulette, you know, plot that's a B plot kind of. You think it's just for a scene, that it's just for torture. And that's the route that he goes down. So I think it all connects. So the movie is breathing. It's giving itself time with things that you don't think are connected to the plot, but actually are in the future.
It's now, like, it does the whole, whatever the gun principle. If you load the gun, you have to use it later in the movie.
Yeah.
It loads the gun literally and uses it later.
Yeah.
And also another interesting thing that I was like, it was another thing that I was a little bit confused about how it worked. So Nicky sent money to Steven.
Yes.
And that's how Mike figured out that he was still in Vietnam and probably playing Russian roulette.
Yeah. And that's kind of a stretch.
Yeah, it's definitely a stretch. Because you're like, Nicky, the guy who seems like he has no emotions when Mike goes to talk to him, is somehow still like sending money to his friend. Like, I don't know. That's the part that was a little confusing. But other than that, whatever, we'll let that slide.
Stop being so realistic, all right? All right, this wasn't for realism. This was obviously fantasy.
Well, you're telling me that this wasn't based on a true life story?
Real? No, it's not. They made this up. The scriptwriters completely made this up. What do you think? They exaggerated the war.
Well, that's the thing. Like, it's interesting though that they exaggerated the war, because it's like, maybe they didn't. Because there was a lot of, I think, humanitarian like terrible things that happened in the Vietnam War.
I completely believe that there was. I believe that there's probably that in every war, just based on that there's always a deviant person.
Yeah, and morals become very gray as soon as war is introduced.
Where's the accountability? I don't know.
War is not like, we could get into this whole discussion, but war is seen as a necessary evil, right? Like, it'd be unrealistic to say we're going to live in a world without war.
I don't think everyone would say it's a necessary evil. I think that they would say, like, it's good. A lot of people would say it's good. I'm not even going to say what I think.
Yeah, I'm not going to say what I think. I want to play out the, like,
That it's a necessary evil.
So some people would say it's a necessary evil.
Yeah.
Some people would say some people would be on the side of like, if another country defends you, obviously you have to defend your country.
No, but that's based on the libertarian right of self-defense, right?
Yeah, right of self-defense. I mean, otherwise it's like, if you don't believe in war, another country is going to believe in war and they're going to conquer you. So it's not going to matter. I mean, you kind of have to believe in war to an extent.
Basically, it comes down to you kill or get killed.
Yeah. That's like, it's, war is so brutal in comparison to how we view our world too.
Yeah.
Today we view our world as being a lot more safe, at least where we're from. Maybe this is not the perspective everyone has.
Ben, not where I'm from. Come on.
Not where Zach is currently at. I'm just kidding. It's still probably not that unsafe compared to a lot of areas. So we view the world as so safe, and war reveals that, oh, people actually are still like shooting at each other. And like, this is a sense that if somebody kills somebody in war, we wouldn't be like, that person's a murderer, even though, like, you know, it's like a different thing. Although we still have some sense of morals that we put into war. Like, you could be a murderer in a war setting. But it's just, as soon as you introduce killing into anything, the lines are...
But when is it okay to torture for information? When is it okay to go too far?
Is it ever okay? Is it not? Is
Hiroshima, Nagasaki. You can get into a lot of different things.
It's a deep... And that's why there's so many movies about it.
Yeah, and I love these movies.
Because every war will present these intensely deep moral and philosophical problems.
Yeah.
And that affect everyone's life, like, incredibly.
Now, so
deeply.
You have, yeah, sorry, I cut you off. You have these three characters that react differently. And then you have this Russian roulette storyline. How do you think, I know this is kind of an abstract question. How do you think, why do you think the Russian roulette storyline was added? I have one theory, and it's very vague.
I could try to make a stab at it. So, I guess just a sense that you have to portray some sort of extreme extent someone goes based off of something that happened to them in a prison setting. Like you had to show a contrast of sorts, so they contrasted that. They probably sort of made up the underground Russian roulette thing so that they could contrast Nikki and Mike's like reaction to the war. That's kind of all I got.
Yeah. I think it just needed to translate from something that happened in the war. They needed the same action. It needed to be an action that could be in war and like played professionally.
Yeah.
I think that was the only thing that could be in included killing, you know. So now this is the hot question that I'm wondering. The title of the movie, Ben, The Deer Hunter. How does that, what is the big thesis of this movie regarding shooting yourself in the head, killing a deer in the shoot by shooting him in the head? That, I mean, what do you think the symbolism is in that?
So is it that, so there's a point in the movie where Mike has a buck in his sights and he lets it go. And then somebody asks him about it and he's like, oh, I had one in my sights, I didn't get it. But I think he let him go. And then there's the point in the movie where Mike is facing off with Nikki and he goes and faces him and he shoots. Now, obviously, he doesn't directly kill Nikki because Nikki kills himself by being involved in Russian roulette. But I don't know. Is it this sense of like, I don't know where the tie is still though, because they're like, he's not hunting. He's hunting Nikki in the sense he wants to hunt him down and bring him back, but he still feels like he has to face off against him. Like, it's a, you're either coming with me or you're not coming back.
But that's what happens. And he causes him to die. He does cause him to die.
So he is the deer hunter.
He is.
The hunter in the sense.
Now, there's a line in the beginning. He says, a deer's got to be taken with one shot. I try to tell people that, but they don't listen. Now, this is kind of what it is. I mean, it's not too unobvious. So with one shot, life can be taken away. With one shot, a deer's life can be taken away. You only need one shot. He misses those shots at the end. He's traumatized, you know. A life can be taken with one shot, and we've been proven with that with Nikki. And this guy has shot both the deer at the beginning of the movie and Nikki at the end of the movie, even though he didn't directly kill Nikki, you know. It was kind of that. And it's just kind of the premise. And, you know, I don't even think the director wants us to blame.
He's not trying to make a moral, like, create a moral dilemma of, oh, was Mike at fault for Nikki's death or anything like that? Mm-hmm. No. But, I mean, yeah, there's definitely a tie there. But
the last question that I kind of have to round this out is, with that central thesis in, why did Nikki know that he was going to kill himself after remembering Mike? He remembered Mike, and then he goes on to kill himself. He didn't know he was going to die, necessarily, but he knew there was a chance.
He recognized Mike.
And right away puts the gun to his head.
And he puts the gun to his head. And it's like, you can't really think of a point in the movie that Mike did anything that slighted Nikki. But has the choices he's made turned him against Mike? Because Mike is the way to freedom from his like mental prison.
Maybe. I don't know. But this is my theory.
Okay, I want to hear it.
So Mike's specific line is, do you remember our hunting trips? Nikki remembers his line, one shot to kill the deer.
Oh yeah.
Nikki kills himself because he doesn't want to live with it anymore. I think that's what he want. He knew it was one shot to kill himself because Mike reminded him. And I think that's why that memory links him shooting. That's just,
I think it's a
fair theory, just because it links everything together.
Yeah,
but you don't know. I don't know.
I mean, I think that's as good of a theory as you're gonna get.
But obviously, I asked some very intimate questions about this movie because I absolutely love this movie. I think it's probably my top 10 right now. I need to figure some stuff out where my top 10 lays. But, yeah, I don't know. What do you think?
I'll say I think it's in my top 20 or top 25.
I mean, Ben's movies are just better than mine. So, of course, it won't reach that.
Yeah, I don't know. I gotta figure some stuff out, too. Yeah, probably. I've seen better movies. No, but, like, the way that it makes me feel, like, that's ultimately what you decide whether you like a movie or not, right? As like the feeling that you're left kind with. After. There's nothing more powerful than that. That's what makes Donnie Darko my favorite movie.
The emotions that you feel.
Yeah.
They can't really grasp our intellect, so they go for emotions.
Well, and like you can acknowledge that something is intellectually impressive.
But what, still that doesn't sell tickets.
And still not be as emotionally tied to it as art. Because you're like combining both intellect and art into one thing.
Even documentaries have a point.
Yeah.
Right?
And some documentaries have more heart than others.
Yeah. Like The Office.
Mockumentaries.
Yeah. But yeah.
So yes, it's a 4.5 out of 5, teetering on a 5 out of 5, for sure.
I haven't even ranked it yet. I need to put it in my Letterboxd. Yeah, I'll probably give it a 5. Because if it's in my top 10, I can have 10 fives, you know?
Yeah.
Sure. I need to figure some stuff out with my top 10, though. It could be a 7. You never know. It could be a 1.
It's
probably not a 1.
Comparatively to the other movies I've seen.
Yeah. I also really liked Full Metal Jacket. I recommend if you guys like to watch people die, watch that movie. There's a lot of death. It's also like a movie where it transitions like into a different movie.
Yeah.
So, and it's a little bit more comedic, and it's Stanley Kubrick. So.
And then the other movie that would fit into that three that I haven't seen, but I've heard lots of good things about, is Apocalypse Now, which is directed by Francis Ford Coppola.
Yeah.
So that would be the other like famous Vietnam one. And then I guess we mentioned Taxi Driver, which is semi-associated with the Vietnam War just because the main character is a Vietnam War veteran.
Yep. So that's all my questions. John Cazale was also in The Godfather. I didn't even
realize I think he was. That's why he looks so familiar.
Yeah. I did recognize
him. And in Dog Day Afternoon. So
yeah.
Both of those movies. Both really good movies.
Yeah.
Sure. Robert De Niro in a lot of movies and Christopher Walken. I don't know about John Savage, though. I'm not sure that he was really like a huge.
Now, George Zunza was actually hilarious in this movie.
That guy, he was hilarious. Yeah.
And he's just in a couple of like The Beast, Dangerous Minds, Crimson Tide. He's in just a lot of weird movies I've never actually heard of.
Yeah.
Oh, he's like a voice actor for some of the Superman cartoons. That's funny. I would expect that.
You never know with some actors where they're going to go.
True.
Sometimes you're like, you feel sad because you're like, I feel like this actor did a really good performance and then for some reason they just never get picked up in anything else that's big. But on the other hand, you could be like, well, they did get to be in a movie that won 5 Academy Awards or, yeah.
Yeah, but Meryl Streep gets one of those every week, you know?
Right.
It's just kind of, it depends.
But. Yeah, what does she have? She has 2 British Academy Film Awards, which nobody cares about, 2 Screen Award Actors Guild Awards, 3 Primetime Emmys, and nominations for Tonys, and 6 Grammy Awards.
She sings?
She has 21 Academy Award nominations, winning 3, which is a pretty good amount. I mean, that's Daniel Day-Lewis type numbers.
That's crazy.
Although Daniel Day-Lewis, she probably won some of her for supporting. Whereas Daniel Day-Lewis going to be winning 3 best actors for 3 different movies.
Okay.
So, not saying that one's better than the other, of course.
But it objectively is.
But objectively, because the Academy, it matters so much. I'm just kidding, it doesn't really.
If the Academy matters so much, like, why do I not care?
Well, I don't think you should care that much. I think people put, like, if you listen to the rewatchables, because they compare everything to sports, the Academy does matter a lot to them. But to me, the Academy is probably going to overlook the actual best, except for, like, sometimes, like Daniel Day-Lewis. Okay, yeah, actually, probably the best actor for There Will Be Blood, that sort of thing. But recently, they've shifted to more, like, indie movies and things, so maybe we're getting actually a look at better movies, but it also feels like there's more of a like, we have to nominate this movie for this cultural reason, and we have to nominate this actor, and it's like,
you know what's funny though?
Not as much based on merit, but who knows.
It's actually kind of funny. So we talked about Taxi Driver and The Irishman and The Godfather, and Robert De Niro's in all those movies too.
Yeah, that's true.
It's just interesting.
Yeah.
That's how influential this guy is.
I mean, De Niro during the 70s and 80s, and De Niro and Pacino were the guys, like, and Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola, those were the directors, and it's not like that anymore. I guess Leonardo DiCaprio, but like, to me, you watch De Niro played so much grittier characters.
True.
Think about
Dirty Grandpa.
De Niro was playing like guys who looked like messed up. He was not like, to me, he was not like he's not a pretty boy in the sense that like, he's not unattractive, but he's not like Leonardo DiCaprio in Titanic is like, you know, just very conventionally attractive. So, you know, you just don't see those characters anymore. They have to like make Robert Pattinson look bad in movies to give him like eyeliner so that he doesn't, or like dye his hair blonde so that he doesn't look so attractive. Somehow that makes him look more attractive, but.
Because you know, Ben. It's because you know it's dying.
I'm trying to think. There's got to be actors who are like, more like character actors, who would be comparable to Robert De Niro at this time. But I just can't think of them off the top of my head.
I don't know. At least there were no Sigma males in this movie.
Yeah, it's true.
It's a nice refresh. There's too many of them these days.
Well, you could argue Mike was a Sigma male.
Mike?
Although he ended up with a girl.
No, Mike was not a Sigma. He was an...
The thing is, they do all everything together, so they're not really Sigmas.
I think he was an alpha in this.
Yeah. Because the whole thing about Sigma males is that they're loners.
He's not a loner. He was trying to get his friend's girl.
Yeah. They're definitely not a loner.
No. So, I guess that makes sense. But yeah, Ben, any final thoughts about the movie?
Well... if you happen to break anything at your wedding, you're going to want to call Hedman Anglin Agency. If you have a wedding at your house, like my neighbors currently are.
At 11:02 p.m.?
Well, they were earlier today
having
a wedding at their house. And so if you happen to have any damage, because you have big crowds at your house, you know, something could get broken. You're going to want to have good home insurance. So I would recommend Hedman Anglin Agency.
Enthusiastic, Ben.
I for some reason closed the okay. Hedman Anglin Agency, known for saving people money on auto, home, and business insurance. This is the real deal. I cannot emphasize you enough.
Really?
Like, you have to have insurance on your car and your house.
Why is that? Why because do I have to so have insurance valuable. On my car? Why?
And if something happens,
I drive
to them,
a 2002 Corolla.
Well. Okay.
Is that really valuable, Ben?
If you're driving that car, do you really have the money if something were to happen to that car to get another car?
Yes.
Maybe you do because you have that car because it's cheap, or maybe that's the only car you can afford.
But convince me why I want car insurance.
It's also illegal to not have car insurance.
Oh, okay.
All right. The government's got you there.
Oh.
So you might as well get one that's going to save you money.
That's a good idea.
And so... call the number. Just call the number. 614-486-7300.
614-486-7300.
I can't really relate insurance to war too much, but
yes, you can. Let's try it. Okay.
Okay. Let's say your house is involved.
I'll be Hedman. You'll be Anglin. All right.
Let's. Oh no, my house was damaged by a mortar. That was.
I'm not gonna insure it.
Well, good thing I already have Hedman Anglin Agency.
No, you don't. You just have Anglin.
I just have Anglin Agency.
Because I'm Hedman. You're not getting my half. I have the home insurance on my side.
Well, I have the car insurance, so the mortar.
Well, good thing I'm in.
The car.
Good thing I live in Venice.
Well, good thing that. Venice is like. That's like C tier European city. I live in Oslo, so that's much cooler.
Nobody knows what that is, Ben.
It's
I mean,
capital
Anglin.
Of Norway. Okay, it's a very underrated city, and Venice gets all the attention because they have stupid canals, but Oslo's cool, so...
But that, yeah. I win. All right, that was a good war. Anyway, call them and tell them that Ben and Zach sent you, and we still have a cardboard cutout of us on the line, because that would be cool.
How many episodes can we still have the cardboard cutout available?
Forever, Ben.
Let's figure out... How long this will take.
Forever.
forever.
Because I want someone to have it. I do. Yeah. I want someone to wake up in the morning and just see Ben, like, staring at them with the creepy face that he makes every once in a while. The one that I don't really like that much. It kind of creeps me out. Yeah, he's doing it right now a little bit. Yeah, that
I one. Probably don't even know how to make it. Like, it's just a natural...
Yeah, instinct. He's not in control of his face. It just spaz... He doesn't have any control. It's kind of spazzing right now.
Yeah.
That's just Ben. That's just how he is. He has some kind of thing going on. I just want to wake up. Maybe I should do this. Maybe I should move out of Venice and get a car and get car insurance, because I would get a cardboard cutout and just wake up, tape the Ben cardboard to the ceiling, and just wake up to Ben's creepy face on my eyes. You know, it would be a really good way to wake up, and it would wake me up. Yeah, because I would probably be startled. Yeah. Now, would I get used to it? I don't think so. Can we get used to Ben's face? No. My answer is no. So, it's a good alarm system. Anyway.
It's going to make sure that you don't fall asleep. You don't get used to your... it's a visual alarm and with an audio alarm.
There's a caption that says, don't get too comfortable. You have like a belt in your hand. We should make it like really weird.
Like we said they were cardboard cutouts, but they're actually like the weirdest cardboard cutouts ever.
Like I'm in a mermaid suit and I have like marijuana in my hand.
It says... yo, bro, hit a smoke today, something
no,
like that.
No, it would say so. I don't know. It wouldn't say anything. Yours would say things are getting out of hand, and you press a button, and it would say that in a creepy voice, and it would be, with the belt.
Things are getting out of hand.
Exactly like that. Exactly. So if that sounds attractive to you, and it does to me. So you should please buy that. I don't know if I'm attracted to different things, but that sounds attractive. Me in a mermaid suit in a cardboard cutout.
And whatever we got going on with me.
Yeah, whatever you want with Ben. Nobody cares.
Nobody cares.
Yeah. But, Ben, I love this movie, but I think it's time for a close, right?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Well, with that, Ben, do you want to close it or something or no?
Yeah.
All right, go ahead.
Right now, I'm going to reenact a deer closing the movie vault. I'm a deer closing the movie vault.
Come on.